Tonight we begin a new series on three important Old Testament figures. In Hebrew, their names are Shemuel, Shaul, and Shlomo. Samuel, Saul, and Solomon. All of them were involved in one way or another with the life of David. Years ago, I did a long series on the life of David. And then recently I was thinking, well, what about these other three? They're also important. Now look at the contrast. Samuel, a very good example. Saul, a very bad example. And Solomon, both good and bad. Very, very wise. But look also at some of the problems he had. Samuel, more significant in Israel's history than we realize. In Hebrews 11, that hall of fame of men and women of faith, he is listed in Hebrews 11:32. Here's something interesting about him, Mr. Shemuel. He was a prophet. He was also a priest. And he was the last of the judges. He said, well, what's significant about that? To my knowledge, none of the men in the Old Testament were prophet, priest, and king. You'd find those that were prophet and priest, or priest and king, or something like that. This is the closest, because the judge wasn't quite a king, but it was similar. Now, there's the book of Judges, and it ended by saying there was no king in the land. Every man did whatever was right in his own sight. And then sometime during the period of Judges, there was Ruth, Boaz, and so forth. And then 1 Samuel picks up after that with the second to last judge named Eli, and that segues into the life of Shemuel, the Samuel. I don't want to call him Sam, but Shemuel, Sam, Samuel. But Jesus was the ultimate prophet, priest, and king. Perhaps that's why no mere human occupied all three offices. It's like someone one day will come that will be the greatest prophet, and he'll be the greatest priest, the high priest, Hebrews says, and he will be the King of Kings. That's our Jesus. So open your Bibles to 1 Shemuel. You didn't know you were going to learn a little bit of Hebrew tonight. Now, there are two books named Samuel, 1 and 2, and there's debate amongst the Hebrew scholars that look at the scrolls, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was perhaps written as one, but because you could only wrap up so much on one scroll, it was divided into two books. He was not the complete author. He is the main person in the first so many chapters, but then he dies. And unless he wrote the Second Samuel after his death, it's not likely, so it's like him and another anonymous author. Some of the ancient Jews thought it was Ezra, but we just don't know. But as we look at the life of him, he's the main character and would give this the inside biography. It's good to know when this happened. Now, you remember God delivered the Jews from Egypt about 1450 B.C., and that moved into the time of the judges for about 400 years. That's what the book of Judges is about. And that led up now to the end of the time of the judges and into the time of the kings. And that's why the next couple of books are called 1 and 2 Kings. And so then, remember there was the 40 years wilderness. You do the math and you say, this is approximately 1050 B.C., Now, the judges were not kings. They were temporary. And as far as I know, no one of them judged all Israel, and certainly not like a king. Sometimes they were just in this one tribe or that, and their influence was elsewhere. It does say such and such judged Israel for 40 years. But they were not kings. They were more like like judges of the Supreme Court. You remember, God planned to be the king of Israel. And we'll see that later when the people said, no, we want a king like the other nations. And Samuel was hurt. And God says, no, they didn't reject you. They rejected me from being king over you. God's plan was that there would not be a human king. But when they went into the promised land, there would be hard cases, and Moses wasn't there anymore, so they'd have these judges, some of which were ordained during the time of Moses. You remember, he was overwhelmed with so many problems, people asking advice on things that God's law didn't concern, so his father-in-law Jethro said, well, what you're doing is not good. You need to appoint all these elders, these other judges that can hear the lower cases and you get the heavy cases. Evidently, that was the beginning of the period of these judges, and that continued after Moses died. And as I said, Eli was the judge at this time, and then he hands it on to Samuel. We'll look at that tonight and tomorrow. Okay, verses 1 to 7, and I won't read every single verse, but it says, don't you envy me having to try to pronounce some of these Hebrew names. There was a certain man of Ramathaim, Zophim, of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. There you go. You read the book of Judges and Joshua, you find a lot of these unusual names. You get to Chronicles, verse after verse. But this is Hebrew. So we're first introduced to Elkanah. Now we find out, as the narrative continues, he was of the tribe of Levi, but he lived in the tribe of Ephraim. To remind you, there were 12 tribes, and Levi didn't get any land. They were to be the priests. What about the two biggest tribes by far were Judah, from which the Messiah would come, and Joseph. But when you read the Bible and look at the maps, you don't find a piece of property for Joseph. Joseph's tribe was so big, it was divided into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. So between those two half-tribes and Judah, that was like 90% of the land and of the population. So Elkanah was from the tribe of Levi. Keep that in mind about his son Samuel, who would be a priest. But he lived in a different area because the Levites didn't have any land. They usually lived close to Jerusalem where the tabernacle would be situated. But this time it was in another place called Shiloh. So Elkanah was a priest. But then it says he had two wives. Verse 2, he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah. Stop right there. We've had more than one Hannah in our church, one tonight. In Hebrew, Hannah, or something. That's where you get Anna, and ones like that. And the other was Penina. Penina had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, what's this about having two wives? It had been forbidden. You remember, God made only one wife, took one rib out of Adam. But you found polygamy, and you find it even among great men like David. Now, you find polygamy, not polyandry. Polyandry would be a woman that had many husbands. That's very rare. There have been a few tribes in Africa that have had polyandry, but the Mormons, of course, believed it. And they said, well, look at here, Elkanah and David and Solomon had 300 wives and 700 concubines and several others. Jacob, one of the patriarchs. The thing is, this was very common in the ancient world, and so God was gradually weaning them away. This tended to be in the first few hundreds of Israel, but as time went on, by the time of Jesus, it was virtually unheard of. And it was like God said, for the hardness of your heart, I will allow divorce and polygamy. That's why they weren't all struck dead. But it was forbidden. And here this man was practicing bigamy, meaning he had two wives. Now, the first one was Penina, and it's been speculated that perhaps he married Hannah first. She didn't have children, so he took a second one in order to have children, just like, you know, the story of Henry VIII. He kept wanting to have children, and one wife wouldn't give. So he divorced her, get another one, he had her head chopped off, finally got a son, and then he died, and that was King Edward VI, but perhaps this is what Elkanah was doing. I got to have children. And Hannah couldn't give some, so he married a second. Perhaps. But it says children. Penina had several children, but Hannah did not. Verse 5 says, why? The Lord closed her womb. Now, this would be a heavy burden for wives that want children. We have had some in our church, and I've known others, and I've had to minister. And like Rachel, they say, give me children or I die. It's a It's a good, godly woman's desire to have children. Strangely, there are women that do not want to have children. That's unnatural, and then you think of abortion and stuff like that, but it's natural, and certainly amongst Jewish women, they wanted to have children, the more and the merrier, but God withheld children from Hannah temporarily. Just like, think about the three wives of each of the patriarchs. Sarah was not able to have children, Rebecca, and then Rachel, and several others mentioned in the Bible. There was Elizabeth in Luke chapter 1, but God opened their wombs and gave them children. But at the beginning here, you can see already, this is already sad. You know, I used to preach on this sometimes at the nursing homes, and I'd always say, it starts sad, and it gets sadder, but it has a happy ending. And this one does, so it's like good drama. And so the setting stage is Hannah is very sad, and Peninnah is taunting her for that. But look at verse 5. Hannah, he, that is Elkanah, would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. It's like Jacob loved Rachel, who couldn't have children, more than Leah, who could have children. In fact, had several children. And so maybe it's because this was his first wife, or he had special pity on her. He still loved her. And there's no indication that he taunted her or blamed her or stopped loving her or just got cold toward her. No, this is a good example. And here's one of our lessons for tonight. Men, listen, a good husband will always love and comfort his wife, like Elkanah. Whatever she's going through, with the children, bad day at work, not feeling well, lonely, whatever. That's where God put husband and wife together so that the husband can comfort the wife like Elkanah did for Hannah. And it says he loved her. Okay, pop quiz. Is there a verse that says something about husbands should be loving to their wife? Now, women, you know the verse, but men, do you know it? Yes, what does it say back there? Husbands, love your wives. It says it also in Colossians. So, husbands, love your wives. That's your primary responsibility. So, it's a good example. Now, by the way, I said an example in the beginning. I said, you know, there are these three men that are good, bad, or bad and good examples. Here's an important principle when you study the Bible and you see stories and special characters in them. Look closely and say, now, is this a good example? Is this a bad example? Is this a mixed example, or is it just kind of nothing in particular, just part of the story? Well, he is a good example. Peninnah is a bad example. And Hannah, if you look closely, she is a good example. She's not blaming God. And he's not blaming her. Meanwhile, get out your handkerchiefs. It gets sadder. Verse 6. Her rival, Peninnah, interesting, calls it the rival, also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her, that is Hannah's, womb. And so this is not just like sibling rivalry where an older brother taunts a younger sister or something. This is two wives. This, by the way, rivalry is one reason why polygamy is wrong. Most women wouldn't want to share their husband with another man, with another woman at the same time. They say, no, he's mine. And so this comes out, this jealousy, in another way with taunting. She provoked him. She teased her. She condemned her. She was cruel toward poor Hannah. She had no sympathy or mercy on her, unlike the husband, Elkanah. Perhaps she was saying, well, God hasn't given you children. You must be a very bad, wicked woman. God's punishing you. That's kind of what Job's friends said about him. You must be very wicked because God wants you to prosper and be in good health. You see, the health and wealth pseudo-gospel was around even back then. So perhaps she was saying, you must be very wicked, Hannah. And if that, of course, that did not help the problem at all. She had jumped to the wrong conclusion. Now, let me throw this in since I mentioned Job's friends. We preached through the book of Job some years ago. And, you know, if we know our Bible, we'd say, yes, they did wrong. What should they have done? It's kind of like, well, good and bad examples. They were bad examples, but when you see a bad example, say, what should they have done for poor Job? What should his wife have done rather than henpecking and nag and blame him? What should they have done? What Job told them. It's early on, I think it's like chapter 6. And he said, to him that is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friends. They weren't showing kindness. Neither was Peninnah. She was taunting. She should have comforted and said, look, you know, we're both wives and we're both women. And, you know, I'm so sorry for you, and help wipe away the tears. She didn't do that. But then Elkanah did. Oddly, the tables have been turned in a very strange way. A woman that's not able to have children today, not likely to get taunted. But a woman that has many, many children. I've had wives that have like 8 or 10 children say when they all go to the grocery store, they can always count on some so-called woman that butts into business and say, what are you doing bringing so many kids into the world? Don't you know this, that, and the other? In other words, they blame a woman for having so many children. I grew up in a Catholic neighborhood, and all my friends came from huge families, like 5, 6, 10 children. But things have certainly changed. So how does Hannah respond? Though they're going to the temple, she's weeping, verses 8 and following. Elkanah, her husband, said to Hannah, why do you weep? Kind of like what the angel said to Mary Magdalene, why do you weep? Who are you looking for? Why do you not eat? In other words, she was weeping and so hard that she was not even able to eat. He says, why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? Notice it's question after question. That's very Jewish, the way that they would ask questions to, and it's kind of like rhetorical questions. And Jews today still like to do that. There's an old story. Anybody remember that columnist Ann Landers? She was Jewish and her sister. And someone sent her a letter and said, why do you Jews always answer a question with a question? And she said, well, why not? Well, here he's asking her questions, but in a tender way. You can see her hugging her and wiping away the tears. Why are you weeping? Why are you not eating? Why is your heart grieved? Now, he knew the answer, but he says, you still have me, and am I not better than even 10 sons? So here's Hannah weeping over and over and over again for two reasons, that she's not able to have children, and secondly, Peninnah is taunting her. Have you parents ever had one of your little ones come home crying and say, you know, honey, what's wrong? Well, the child at school made fun of me. And so that's like what she's going through here. It's bad enough not having kids, but to have someone in the same tent making fun of her and blaming her. And I'm sure that when Hannah started weeping, Peninnah just smiled. You know, people like that, kind of like bullies. People that want to bring someone to tears. So she is so hurt that she's losing all of her appetite. Some say she's fasting. I'm thinking, no, it's because of the grief. Depression and grief can do that. David said, I'm weeping so much that I can't even eat. It's in one of the Psalms. And so she's weeping. Can you picture her weeping over and over again? I want children. I want children. Lord, have mercy on me and keep Peninnah from blaming me. Help, Lord. And so she's weeping, and God sees every one of those tears, and God sees our tears. Here's a precious verse in the Bible. This is one of my mother's favorite. Wish y'all had known my mother. She always loved that verse where God said, I have stored up your tears in my bottle. They're precious to God. My mother was a weeper. She wept a lot, and I guess I picked some of that up from her. Psalm 54 is one of my favorites. Is that the one about the tears in the bottle? Yes. All right. God sees every single one of the tears of his children, just like parents will, especially the mother can almost sense, here come the tears. You know, I can just see it, the little quivering of the bottom lip of that little child about to cry, or that little boy trying to act like a man, and then he breaks down in tears. The mother sees it, and God sees all of our tears. He saw Hannah's tears. Now, you'll notice here it says that they went up to worship, verse 3, to Shiloh. The tabernacle was there, wasn't moved to Jerusalem. That was in David's day. And it mentions Eli, and then it goes back to saying they're going back to the tabernacle, verse 9. Here's another lesson. Even when our heart is broken, we should still go to church. Sometimes a person says, my heart is so lonely, I'm hurting, I'm going through depression, I'm worried. Well, you should still go to church. Be with God's people, and perhaps someone will notice something's wrong. We should be sensitive. Someone might, in fact, here's a preacher's secret. Whenever there's a church of more than 50 people, there's always going to be someone there with a broken heart or fear or some affliction nobody else knows about. And a tender, sensitive heart will notice that if you notice. If you ever notice, sometimes you can just see it in someone's face when they think nobody's looking. You can tell that person's going through something. So why not go up and say, is everything okay? Anything I can do? Share a little comfort and encouragement with that person. And so if you're going through a tough time, go to church. Just like Hannah and Elkanah did. And of course, then Peninnah would go along with her kids, and you wonder whatever happened to those kids. They maybe imitated their crusty mother. And there we're introduced also to Eli, who is a priest and a judge, but not a particularly good one. We'll see about his sons. Okay, back to the text. Verse 10. Here's Hannah going to the tabernacle, and there was Levi sitting there outside, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. Notice how God inspired these extra words. This doesn't say, well, she was hurt and she prayed and wept. No, it says in anguish and in bitterness. Very colorful language for this poor woman. And it says bitterness because emotional pain can turn to bitterness. But bitterness is not the same thing. Anguish of soul is legitimate. Bitterness is when it festers like a boil and it comes out bitterly. So she's on the verge of getting bad. Bible talks about a root of bitterness in the book of Hebrews. But she does pray, and there's another lesson. She did the right thing. She's a good example. She took her tears to God, and so should we. Sometimes there's nothing else that we can do, no one else to talk to. We can always talk to God. And sometimes words fail us. The emotions go over us. David said he's drowning in his tears in his bed, and he says, all your billows, all your waves are over me. And there are times that we can't even talk in prayer, like she says here. It says that her lips were moving, but no words were coming out. So she prayed. And she wept in anguish, like Rachel, give me children or I die. And she probably felt it was hopeless. Nothing's wrong with weeping. Women tend to weep more than men, but I read a book not long ago about tears and why people weep and statistics and biological things. Look at the weepers in the Bible. David, frequently. Anybody that says, well, it's not manly for a man to weep, you're not half the man as David. He killed Goliath. He was a general and all these other things. Yet he regularly wept, even openly. Peter wept after he denied Jesus. Paul said he often wept. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet. And of course, above them all, the Lord Jesus. And not just in Gethsemane. He wept over Jerusalem. He wept at the grave of Lazarus. And there are many other such examples. And here's one here. Hannah, she felt it was hopeless. So all she could do is just break down and cry. And when a person's in that state, they don't just pray, they beg. Now, some people don't know how to beg in prayer because they've never really been heavily burdened. And like if they're praying for their sick child or something like that, there's a difference between just praying and begging, where you're on your hands and knees weeping, God, please help, 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 help. Begging like a beggar on the streets of Calcutta, please, I'm starving. But I suspect some of you here have been in that state where you beg God, you're pleading with God. I've had to comfort parents and pray with them. I remember praying with one couple that were not able to have children, and she was just weeping her heart out. And then with other couples, my little girl's in the hospital, or my father's about to die, and they've just... And so they're begging God, please have mercy, please, please, please. Sometimes we beg more on behalf of someone that we love more than ourselves. But there's nothing wrong with begging God. And maybe You feel like Hannah, where you say, Lord, please, and then you can't even say anything. The tears say it all. Look at her prayer, next verse. So she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look upon the affliction of your maidservant. Notice how often she describes herself as the maidservant. She knows her place. And remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child. Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. So she takes this vow. Such vows are allowed if you do them properly. Maybe it's time for me to preach on vows, but we have a good handout. We got a handout on everything out there. One on oaths and vows. Very good biblical study. And God does allow it. This would be what's called a votive kind of promise. Usually it involves words like, if you do this, then I will do this. It's like a covenant or a mutual promise. And so she's not wheeling and dealing with God or forcing him into a corner. She says, please, if you do this, I will give him back to you. So she's crying out for mercy, and so she would. And so she says, if you give me this male son, I will give him back to you, and he'll serve you all the days of his life. He said, what's this business about no razor? Is that saying that beards are right or wrong? Well, the custom was for men to have beards in. It's a custom. It wasn't a commandment. But what she is saying is, I will dedicate him that he will be a Nazarite. Hands up, everybody heard of a Nazarite in the Bible? It's, almost everybody here. It's in Numbers 6, where a Jewish man, in rare cases a woman, would take a special vow, usually temporary. Paul took a temporary one. Did you know that in the book of Acts? It says he shaved his head, for he had had a vow. The time of his vow was over, so he now shaved his head. But for that period of time, like a Nazarite was not allowed to get a haircut or to trim his beard. That's why it says no razor. They didn't have scissors back then. We're told in Numbers 6 that a Nazarite was not allowed to drink wine or strong drink like alcohol, nor even to eat grapes, because that's where wine comes from, and they may have been sitting around in the garden a little bit too long and become fermented. So don't even come close to that. And then they're also told they were not allowed to touch a dead body, even if it was a close relative, or they would be defiled and they'd have to confess and bring a certain sacrifice. So some were temporary, but others were permanent, lifelong. Samson. And think about that with how long that hair must have been when he was an adult. John the Baptist was a lifelong Nazarite for about 35 years. Paul, temporarily. And Shemuel. Now, he lived to be a ripe old age and never had a haircut. Yo, how long was his hair be after 80 years? Plus his beard looks like, you know, the old man on the mountain. Question, was Jesus a Nazarite? No. He was a Nazarene, not a Nazarite. Nazarite comes from a word, Nazir, which means like separated, but Jesus was from Nazareth, therefore he was a Nazarene. It's a completely different concept. And by the time of Jesus, the only men that had long hair were Nazarites. All the others had relatively short hair, and Jesus touched dead bodies. Of course, he had raised them, and Jesus drank wine at the Last Supper and so forth, and at the wedding. So here's the covenant, the vow. Give me a child, I'll give him back to you. And the Lord answered it. Okay, back to the text, verse 12. It happened as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli watched her mouth. So he's outside the temple, and there she is kneeling, weeping. And it says, Hannah spoke in her heart. Her lips moved, but a voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought that she was drunk. She prayed and kept on praying. We see this over and over and over again. Lesson for us. Keep on praying. James 5 says, the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Same thing for righteous women. Fervent prayer becomes effectual and avails much. Have you ever heard the old proverb? More things are accomplished in this life than the whole world ever dreams of. That's true. God is answering your prayers more than you realize, and not always in the way you think. And same thing with Hannah. So here's Eli, fairly old man, looking on, probably sitting out there stroking his beard like, get this woman out of here, she's drunk. It's in the morning. It's and outside the tabernacle of all places. And so he sees her and he jumps to the wrong conclusion. But notice it says she spoke in her heart, but her lips simply moved, but there was no words coming out. True prayer starts in the heart. As I said, sometimes it's too deep for words and it just simply comes out as tears. I imagine some of you have prayed like this. I certainly have. Well, you're so overcome, the words don't come up, and you're so overcome by the grief, anguish, and whatever, that it even affects your mind, so you're just drowning in emotion. In fact, Isaiah 38:14 says that sometimes people are like this. They can't even talk, and they just make little noises that sound like an animal, like a groan. Ooh, or, ooh. Have you ever heard people in the Middle East? You've seen it on TV. Saeed can tell us in parts of the Middle East, they women wail. It sounds like some kind of a bird. In other words, they're so overcome with emotion, it just comes out like an animal sound. And so here's Hannah. She wasn't saying anything. It was just overwhelmed with emotion. Now, here's a principle. It's better to pray with the heart without the lips than to pray with the lips without the heart. Think about that. Her prayer was acceptable even though it wasn't spoken. It was wept out, but Eli jumps to the wrong conclusion, thinks she's drunk because she's not saying anything, and I guess looked like a drunken woman. Better to pray with the heart without the lips than to pray with the lips without the heart. And there are, what do you call a person who prays with the lips without the heart? Hypocrite. Jesus rebuked the Pharisees for that. They were showing off. So Eli, being a judge, should have asked her what's wrong, should have comforted her, but he jumps to the wrong conclusion. Like Job's friends and like Penina, bad example. In fact, there's not much good said about Eli except that he was a judge. Let's don't imitate them. Let's don't learn to win Olympic gold medals in conclusion jumping. Jumping to the wrong conclusion. We see someone and we say, well, he must be wrong. Or you know the old thing. Someone on the jury says, well, he must be guilty. His eyes are too close together. Or there is one that said, well, you never put a woman on the jury because she'll convict a woman because she's wearing the wrong dress. Well, that's silly. But people do jump to wrong conclusions. They look at a person's appearance or something like that, and they jump to the wrong conclusion. Let's give people the benefit of the doubt. That doesn't hurt. Eli didn't do it. We should. And give them the benefit of the doubt and get a little bit more information. Back to the text. So he goes up and rebukes her. How long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you. Wrong. So Hannah now is able to muster some words, controls her emotions, says, no, my Lord, shows respect. I'm a woman of sorrowful spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink. Intoxicating drink there probably means spirits that are much stronger than wine. But I poured out my soul before the Lord. There's an interesting wordplay here. I haven't been pouring wine into me. I've been pouring my soul out before the Lord in the form of these tears. And so she's defending herself. And we need to pour out our tears before God, before the very last drop. And then she continues, verse 16, do not consider your maidservant, notice again, maidservant, a wicked woman. Out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now. So she explains it. And that convinced Eli he was wrong. And so evidently God spoke to him. So he says, answered and said, verse 17, go in peace. The God of Israel has granted your petition, which you have asked of him. God. Yes. And also that like the high priest in Jesus' day, John 11, being high priest, he prophesied. So being a judge, he prophesied and said, well, go in peace. God's going to give you just what you ask. So this is a better example coming out of old Eli. It says, God has heard you. God sees our tears as well as hears the groans of our heart. Isn't that wonderful? What a wonderful, loving Father we have. And he may answer us exactly as we prayed for. And if he does, be sure to thank him, as we'll see in the next chapter. Hannah did. But what if God doesn't give you exactly what you ask for? Don't blame him. Trust him. That's the test. Trust him anyway. Even if God doesn't give you what you ask for, he's got his reasons. Search the scriptures, you might find some of them out. And even if you don't, say, I'm going to trust God anyway, even with my tears. Also, sometimes just keep on praying. He may not answer you with the first prayer. It may take 100 prayers or many years. And he may answer us just as we prayed for, as he did with Hannah. See, this is loaded with personal lessons. Verse 18, so she says, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. Favor is another word for grace. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So she believed God, therefore she was no longer sad. Here's another principle. Faith in God and his promises brings hope and comfort, even though the baby hadn't come yet. It's still 9 months away, but she believed the promise, just like Abraham believed he'd have a son, even though he wasn't able to. And so did Sarah, even though she laughed. Faith in God brings hope to cope and to comfort. Very important to trust God in prayer and in affliction, depression, and other such tearful burdens. Okay, the next section, 19 to 23, it says she went her way, verse 19, the husband and perhaps Peninnah, they arose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord, returned, came back to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. Anything important there stands out? They arose early in the morning. It's not saying, well, we got to get up early in the morning. No, keep going. They worship before the Lord. Not only should we go to church when we're heavily burdened and pray and weep, continue to worship God. That's when it's really glorious. When you got tears streaming down your face, you might be in physical pain, you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, and you're trying to hold on to God's promises, and you worship God anyway. Have you any idea how God glorifying that is? The angels probably said, how can that person worship God? Didn't Job do that? God gave, he took away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Woo, boy, that is so God glorifying. That is a test of someone's spiritual character. They worship, including Hannah. God, I haven't had that child yet, but I'm going to worship you anyway. She trusted, and trust produces love and worship, and they go back home here. Notice it says she went her way, they go back home. There's a lesson there, too. There are a lot of little lessons here. She didn't just stay at the temple. She didn't just wallow in her tears. She got on with her business, taking care of the family, maybe even taking care of Peninnah's children. There's a lesson here. I want to see a show of hands, especially from the ladies. How many of you have heard of Elizabeth Elliot? She was not a spiritual giant. She was a giantess. She spoke at our church back in Texas, and she left many books. Very, very godly woman. And you know that her husband was a martyr. She remarried, and he also died, and then she later had Alzheimer's and died. And her books are still well worth reading. We got about a dozen of them in our church library. When she'd travel and speak to women's group, every time afterwards, there'd always be a line of women coming, and they'd break down and cry, oh, Elizabeth, my husband, my children, oh, Lord. And she'd comfort them and wipe away the tears and maybe quote a Bible verse. And she'd always say this, now, go and do the next thing. Now, she had a kind of a school marm way about her. She'd, okay, take your tears to Jesus. Now, go and do the next thing. What's that? There's still always some next thing. You got laundry to do. You got food to cook. You got to do this. You got to go shopping. There's always something. Don't just wallow. Go and do the next thing. Go your way. Go back home and do the next thing. And that's good advice. I'll give you a little hint. At our next Bible conference, Joel Beakey's wife is going to speak to the women on this sort of a subject. How to keep on in the midst of trials. So, whet your appetite for 1 year from now. So they're back home. And they trusted God, but notice it says he knew his wife. Now, that's a euphemism for intimate sexual relations. And just like there was these other husbands like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then later Zacharias. And you said, well, if they trusted God's going to give the baby, well, why not just wait and not have relations? They knew that God uses means. God gives children, but he does it through the father and mother. And so remember that God may answer our prayers, but God will do it also through means. Martin Luther used to say, God uses means. He promises to feed his children, but it's like that mother bird will feed all the young ones, but he does, you know, the worms don't fall out of the sky. That mother bird has to go pick them up and drop them in the mouths. And he says, God will feed us and he'll answer our prayers, but he will use means. It's up to us to trust him and say, now, what are the means God wants me to do? And so we see Elkanah and Hannah said, well, let's do what God will use if he's going to give us a child. And that God, it says here, the Lord remembered her. Now, that's not like he forgot, now he remembers. God never forgets. This is another Hebrew way of saying the Lord never forgot her and never forgot that he would answer her prayer. Verse 20, it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son. Process of time, that would mean, you know, 9 months. And called his name Shemuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. Happy day when little Shemuel came into the world. Notice it says God gave Hannah conception. All conceptions, all children are from God. They're a blessing from the Lord. And she remembered that and gave him the name Shemuel, which means heard by God. Notice the El at the end of Shemuel means Elohim. Been heard. God heard my prayers. It's interesting how parents choose names for their children. Jews had always some special significance in this. And so then verses 21 and 22, now Hannah stays home to care for the little baby Samuel. And that's both a duty and a wonderful privilege for mother. Feels, you know, right at home, taking care of the little ones. It's part of her nature. Now this is a lesson, it says here, that Elkanah went back to offer the sacrifice at the temple, but Hannah didn't go up because she says, well, the child is still a baby, and Peninnah's certainly not going to take care of her, and I evidently know others, babysitters, so I'm going to take care of him. And so she would worship at home, and there's a lesson that applies today. As I said, you know, you go to church, but there are times that a mother should stay home with a sick child or with a baby, like Rachel is home now because of the new baby. He's not strong enough. Wait a while, and then we have nurseries and so forth, but better to stay home with a sick child. By the way, let me throw this in as a pastor. Sometimes it's one sick child and five that are well, and the whole family stays home. I always wonder, why can't just the mother stay home with that one child and the father take the rest of them to church like some of you fathers do? But in any case, they didn't have daycare there, and sometimes daycare is important. We have a church nursery. And other women in the church can and should help new mothers. Have any of you mothers contacted Rachel? Can you bring food? Can you help babysit for the other child while Rachel is caring for the new child? I wonder how Peninnah felt at this point. She's probably thinking, uh-oh. Probably wanted to go and hide away. God did give her a child. And I can't taunt her anymore. Was she ashamed? Well, we're not told. Okay, next section, 24 to 28. She says she weaned him. In other words, she took care of him until she was old enough, perhaps 3 years old, and she kept her vow. She took him up with her together with, look at this generous gift, 3 bulls, 1 ephah of flour, a skin of wine. And he said, well, how much is all that? Well, you want to know how much 3 bulls are worth? Ask Steve Andrus. They got a cattle auction coming up. 3 bulls is a lot, not to mention all this flour and so forth. They bought that, and they brought him up to the Lord to be dedicated, and the child was still very young. So she not only had that vow, she now gives what's called a votive offering, which is similar to a thank offering. That principle applies to us today, even though we don't bring bulls to church and ephahs of flour. Has God ever blessed you in a special way with one of your prayers and you say, Lord, I just want to give you a special thank offering. How can I do that? Not just some extra gift in the offering, but some extra thing you say, I want to not only honor my vow, but I want to say thank you in a big way. If you have that attitude, God will open a door where you can give a special gift for someone in need or a missionary or something like that. Just a good way of showing thanks like Hannah did. So she brings a little lad to dedicate him to church. Perhaps he is around 3 years old. And it says they slaughtered the bull, brought the bull to Eli. And she said, oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you praying to the Lord. You remember me? Yep, yep. For this child I pray, and the Lord has granted me my petition. I can just see the smile on her face, which I ask of him. Therefore, I have also lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord. And they worshiped the Lord there. So they dedicated him. Being Jews, he would have been already circumcised on the eighth day. He said, but they weren't at the tabernacle. Well, this would be done locally by a rabbi. Notice she gives God the glory and the thanks. The Lord has granted this to me. And parents should thank God for giving them children. And we should thank God. Every good thing comes down from the Father of lights above, James chapter 1. Now, earlier it says, I will give him. Here it says, I lend him to the Lord. But it's the same basic idea. He's yours, Lord. Now, this is not the basis for infant baptism, but perhaps for infant dedication. And it's not an ordinance or sacrament per se, though we do find examples. The parents brought the children to Jesus to lay hands and bless them. And we have occasionally done it in church years. And if parents want their children to dedicate in public, fine, I'll do that. But it's also dedicating the parents to the Lord. Lord, I am dedicating myself as well as this child. Use me. I dedicate myself for long hours at night taking care of this child and so forth. And it's never too late to dedicate your children to the Lord. This was a young lad. What about older children that are now prodigal children? That are up and out and they break their parents' heart. Sometimes those parents have never really dedicated that child and given that child to the Lord. I'll tell you a story. There was a woman in our church here, and she was very godly. And I took her with me once to visit a couple who had a very prodigal child of about 20 that was breaking their heart and was wild as can be, was in trouble with the law and drugs and so forth. The mother was just weeping, weeping. What do I do? And so this older woman said, you need to give that child to the Lord. You never really dedicate. Oh, you thought you did. But when you dedicate it to the Lord, you're saying, Lord, there may be rough times coming, but he's yours, Lord. And the mother never really done. So the older mother said, I know just what this is like. When one of my sons was born, we never really dedicated him. We weren't Christians. Later, I became a Christian. He became very, very wild. And I wept and wept and wept. And I came to the point, I said, Lord, he's yours. Do whatever is necessary. Just save his life and save his soul. That woman was my mother. And the Lord heard her prayers and saved me. And I'm still remembering the prayers and tears of my godly mother. And she passed that on to this other woman, who I won't name, who's not with us now, and said, God heard my prayers. You need to dedicate that rebellious son, even if he's prodigal. Give him to the Lord. No strings attached. He's yours, Lord. And so it's never too late to dedicate children to the Lord. How does this end? So they worship the Lord there. They keep worshiping. You see, faith and trust in God and prayer and tears should lead us to worship the Lord more. Now, we won't go through all of chapter 2. Verses 1 and 10 is her song of praise. Well, here's a lesson. She composed this beautiful poetry, and it would be sung in addition to giving some special thank offering. Have you ever thought of just writing out a poem or composing a song just between you and the Lord? Think about that. And then verse 11, Elkanah went to his house at Ramah, and the child ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. I imagine it was sad when they said, okay, Shemuel, you'll be staying here. There's Eli, and you'll be helping him out. Goodbye, we'll see you next time we come back to the tabernacle. And I imagine it was sad when they hugged him. But they kept the vow. She didn't go back on it and said, I made that vow, but I'm going to change my mind. No. The Bible says better to vow, better not to vow than to vow and not pay. If you take a legitimate vow, you better obey it and not look for a way out, loopholes and exceptions. She kept it, and the child was left there ministering to the Lord before Eli the priest. Now, Eli was old and little Samuel was young. You say, well, there should have been some mother figure. Perhaps there were some women helping out in the tabernacle that would help with him various things in a motherly way. How do I know that? Because we do find a few examples in the Bible. By the way, those examples are how the Catholic Church says, see, they were nuns back in those days. I can think of one, Jephthah's daughter. He didn't slay her. He dedicated her to serve in the temple and never get married. So it's comparable, I guess, in a general way to nuns. So there were men helping out in the tabernacle, some were Levites, and there would probably be women, so perhaps some of the women would help with little Shemuel. Now, the rest of the chapter, what a contrast between little godly Samuel and Eli's grown sons who were prodigal. He never disciplined them. They were immoral and greedy, and God judged them and broke Eli's heart. So we won't need to go into that. Just notice the contrast of the good example and the bad examples. Okay, verses 18 and 19. Samuel ministered before the Lord even as a child. And we'll see the call of him in the next chapter. Wearing a linen ephod. What's special about that? Well, it was more than just a nightgown, kind of like a sack. This was a linen ephod is what the priests wore, and only the priests. Remember, David wore one when he was dancing before the Lord. You're acting like a priest out there. Well, it was like he was being prepared to be a priest. Remember, his father was a Levite. Moreover, you mothers like this. His mother used to make him a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. She would make this little gown for him as he grew up and said, well, you need a bigger robe now and another linen ephod and you know, you've outgrown those shoes. Get you some more sandals. And made by Mother Hannah. A good mother, Bible says, clothes her children. Would you mothers know where that is said? Proverbs 31. Takes care of the children. Feeds them. Clothes them. Whether you make them or buy them, provide for them. Just like Hannah did. She didn't just say, well, I'll leave that to Eli and the women in the tabernacle. It says, Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, the Lord give you descendants from this woman for the loan that was given to the Lord, and they would go back to their own home. And the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three more sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the child grew up. Can you think of a Bible verse on this? Three more. She wasn't able to have anymore. Now she has four sons and two daughters. That happened with Abraham. After Sarah died, he remarried and life in the old dog yet, God multiplied with his next wife. And that happened here. The verse to remember is Ephesians 3:20. Anybody know that verse? God is able to do abundantly, exceedingly abundantly above all we think or imagine. She prayed for one child and look how many more she got. Brother Vic, I got to throw this in. I love Spurgeon. He had a godly mother, and when he got saved and he grew up and became a preacher, and became a Baptist preacher, the mother was a Methodist. And she said, well, you know, I prayed and the Lord gave me a son. I didn't expect him to be a Baptist. And he said, well, God gave you more than you asked for. I like that. Good old Spug. You look closely at verses 21 and 26. The Lord visited her. She conceived. The child grew before the Lord. Verse 26. Child Samuel grew in stature and in favor both with the Lord and with men. The hand of the Lord was upon him. This is echoed in the New Testament. Luke chapter 2, Jesus says twice, he grew in favor and in grace and in favor before people, said something's going to good come out of this lad. So they were keeping an eye on little Shemuel. Meanwhile, verses 27 to 36, back to Eli's family, a prophet shows up and predicts gloom for Eli, and it came to pass. We needn't get into that. That's not. We're getting back to Samuel. And so that ends our introduction to Samuel, Shemuel. Next week, we're going to look at the call of little Samuel, and you know the story, and we're going to look at some of the interesting details. So come back as we continue our study on the three S's, Shemuel, Shaul, and Shlomo. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the good example of Hannah and Elkanah and little Samuel, and help us to even learn from the bad examples of Peninnah and Eli and his terrible sons. Help us to be good examples to others by your grace. In Jesus' name, amen.